Welcome to the Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church.
Welcome to Keys of the Kingdom. I'm Brother Gregory, and we're going to talk about the Kingdom of God. We're doing a series on words, looking at the meaning of words, words like religion, words like faith. We'll even look at words like God and what they meant at the time they were used in the Bible, in the Old Testament, in the New Testament, as well as how they were used in modern documents or semi-modern documents such as the Constitution. I mean, the word religion is mentioned in the Constitution. What was the definition of religion at the time the Constitution was written? If you use the dictionary that is specifically oriented to defining the words of the Constitution, what did religion mean when they said that the government couldn't make any laws accepting the establishment of religion? Because what they meant by religion then is what the document means, not what you think the word religion means today, or what it means today when most people use it. It means what it meant at that time. And we're going to look at a particular word today. This is the third in the series of articles that I've written for newswithviews.com. And we're going to look at the word jury. Now, jury, what does that have to do with religion and faith? Well, you might be amazed at where research will take you if you look at the big picture. In this series, we have been showing how the changing of the meaning of words can shape the thinking of society, and therefore, the very nature of society can be altered by changing the meaning of words and how you use them. These changes have taken place back and forth throughout history, over centuries of time, sometimes with disastrous results, because when you start changing the nature of society, it's like a cancer. A cancer is changing the nature of a cell, so that the cell loses its identity and now becomes what we call a cancer cell. And it does not fit into the natural scheme of a body, and therefore you get a tumor growing or a cancer growing that kills the body. And the body has systems within it to kill off cancer cells. Cancer cells are born all the time, and if the body is functioning properly, it will kill those cancer cells, destroy them, devour them, and the body will remain healthy. But if those mechanisms are removed, such as the case of P54, which is a protein that is used to attach itself to cancer cells and cause those cancer cells to be devitalized and even die. And the P54 protein has been occupied fighting a virus that was introduced into the bloodstream of people by polio vaccine. That's right, there was a extra riding virus from the monkey, a monkey virus that was entering into your body. It didn't actually make you sick, you didn't get crippled or anything, but it would attach itself to the P54 protein so that that protein could no longer stop cancer cells that began to develop. And so it used up that mechanism within your body to protect your body so that you could not defend yourself against other malfunctions in the body, and people develop numerous cancer cells and died of brain cancers and what have you, and there's lots of people who have died from that. It can be traced back to that original vaccination, but that takes time and money, and there really isn't any advantage to that because it might make people paranoid about taking vaccinations, and that's a $1 billion business. So anyway, without getting too far off our subject, the point is that by changing the meaning of words so that you think that you are practicing religion when you are not, will alter the nature of your society. Once we understand that Abraham came and Moses came and Jesus Christ came to set men free. I mean, the Bible talks about freedom, it talks about bondage, it talks about government. And if you take elements of your society and neutralize them so that they are no longer functioning the way that God intended society to function, society may become ill, dysfunctional, sick, and decay, degenerate, and collapse. And of course, this has happened throughout history. Most people don't see it because they study history today in school, and actually they don't even hardly study it in school, but when I was younger, they studied history in school, and history was marked by battles and by kings and by presidents, and these are the things that supposedly drove society, when reality, society is driven by the spirit within the community, within each individual person and within each individual family. That's what drives society. And if you disconnect the family and the individual from these elements of society, society will decay. And the best way to do that, or one of the most common ways to do that, is to change the meaning of words. So, in this modern age, there is no immunity to the crippling effects and subtleties of disassembling society through sophistry, through the changing of the meaning of words, because you will disconnect society and the members of society from elements of society that they need to attend to in order to remain healthy, in order to deactivate cancerous entities that rise up in your community. And many of those cancerous entities that we see rising up in your community, we call them criminals. Criminals go out, rob people, beat people, kill people, and we arrest them and we stop them from doing this, just like white blood cells go out and stop cancer cells. Problem is, when you begin to disassociate from these elements of society where you tend to these weightier matters, those criminal elements of society will actually take over the body. They will actually run society. They will operate media. They will operate in political arenas. They will operate in religious arenas such as churches. And they will operate in the Boy Scouts. They'll operate in any institution. And they will take over those institutions and direct them in the way that they see fit, which is contrary to the natural scheme of things in the body. And the whole society will begin to break down. Just like a human body breaks down as those cancers spread. You know, you always hear about, no, the cancer was in his liver, but now it spread elsewhere. It was in his whatever, and then it spread to his liver, and then it went to his blood, and it spread all over, and he's only got 2 weeks to live. This is what's happening in society. So in order to identify the nature of these cancers, we need to become aware of the way in which man was meant to be. Man was made in the image of God. And God is interested in things like law, judgment, mercy, and faith. Christ was interested in those things. He spoke about them as the weightier matters. And the weightier matters, I brought this up to a whole room full of pastors. I said, what did Jesus list as the weightier matters? And these are all pastors, all studied the Bible for years. They could not answer what Jesus said was the weightier matters. Weightier matters are what Jesus said was important. That's why he calls them the weightier matters. And they couldn't list off what Jesus said was important. As a matter of fact, some of those same pastors actually discount the words of Jesus, saying, oh yeah, he said that, but that doesn't count because after he was crucified, that was all done away with. Well, he knew where he was headed. Why was he giving us these instructions? And now you're throwing those instructions out because you imagine that he threw them out when he became crucified and died for our sins. The reality is, he didn't throw anything out. He meant what he said. And he says, those who love me will keep my commandments. And unfortunately, these pastors are not. And the reason why is somebody changed the meaning of words. And they don't know what the word religion means. They don't know what the word faith means. But today we're going to look at the word jury. before we examine a more commonly misunderstood word that will likely turn your world upside down, we need to look at this word jury to set a foundation for the truth. Not that the word jury is misused, but that when you use the term, you need to know that all juries are not created equally. You know, man is supposedly created equally. We're endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights. And rights are obligations or responsibilities. But all juries, they're not created by God. They're created by men, by agreements. And they are not all created equally. Some juries have different rights and obligations than other juries. Some juries have powers that other juries do not have. Well, that's what we're going to look at, is these two fundamental differences of power or lack of power, or right or lack of right, that are found in two different kinds of juries. Now, you can categorize them in lots of different ways: petite juries, admiralty juries, common law juries, and all these things. But we're just going to look at these two aspects of the rights and power of a jury. The right of the jury to decide fact and law. That's a term you'll see often, fact and law, or laws and facts, is often called jury nullification. The power of the jury to decide both fact and law is called jury nullification. It is the power to acquit, even though the facts clearly prove that the individual is guilty of the charges. The jury still decides to acquit, let them off, because they decide that it would be injustice to impose those laws or to hold that individual accountable to the charges against him. And so they nullify the law, the statute, you know, the edict of the king or whatever. They nullify it because they say, yes, he violated the Conventicle Act of 1619. And had a religious ceremony other than the Church of England. This was actually a case that took place years ago, a famous jury nullification case with William Penn. He was actually meeting with Quakers, and that was against the law, according to the Conventicle Act that had been passed by the government. You could only have church meetings if they were Church of England, and Quakers were not Church of England. So he was arrested, and the jury... At first, they couldn't convict him. They couldn't come to a conclusion. And this upset the judge, so the judge sent them back to quarters to stay overnight. And the only quarters they had wasn't the Best Western Motel down the street, or even a Six Motel. It was actually the jailhouse. They were sent to jail to stay overnight. And they brought them back in the next day, and the judge wanted a guilty verdict because it was clear that he had had this church meeting. Well, they said he was innocent. They didn't come back with a guilty verdict. They didn't come back with a hung jury. They came back with he's innocent. And this was clearly to do with an individual that was on the jury who was a very wealthy man, a well-learned man, who said the jury has a right to decide fact and law, and the fundamental right to choose the way in which you defend, you know, practice your religion, your beliefs, that's up to you. You don't have to practice them according to the Church of England. And so they nullified the law, the Conventicle Act, and they said he's not guilty. Well, this enraged the judge, and he sent him back to jail. And he did this every day. And eventually he had to let William Penn go, but he didn't let the jury go, because he held the jury. He said they were in contempt of court because they wouldn't come back with a guilty verdict. Well, eventually, he imposed fines on them. The rich man paid most people's fines, but he himself, along with a few others, I think, stayed in jail for a very long time, refusing to come back with anything but an innocent verdict. Now, William Penn's already gone, but they wouldn't pay the fine. They said that this is our right. This is our right to jury nullification, our right to decide fact and law. And this is a famous case. It used to be known by every American. At the time of the American Revolution, there was probably not an American who was not familiar with the William Penn case. Today, Americans are often completely unfamiliar with that case, and they don't even know what the word jury nullification even means. But it appears from time to time. And so we're going to explore that and explore the meaning of words, and we're going to eventually get around to understanding one of the mysteries of the universe. And jury nullification is one of those essential powers of a free society. This is one of the most powerful tools of a free people in tending to the weightier matters of what Jesus calls law, judgment, mercy, and faith. There was a time when they used to call me for jury duty. After reading some comments in a jury concerning jury nullification in a jury handbook, published actually by the Oregon Bar Association, and a number of judges were involved in the writing of this little handbook that they made available to us during what they called jury orientation. You had to go into jury orientation, and they gave you a little lecture. The judge came out and told everybody, they weren't on a jury yet, but they were the pool from which they would call a jury. And there was one of these little pamphlets on every chair, and I picked it up and read it. Most people did not read it, and most people who did read it probably didn't understand it. But I wrote a series of letters to the local judge who said that we could contact him if we had any questions. And eventually he sent me to the state court administrator to get the answers that he didn't provide, which he actually didn't provide any answers whatsoever, and we'll get to that. I've been in courtrooms since I was a small boy and listened to things about court, had law explained to me since I was a small boy. My dad would take me into his study, and on the blackboard he'd go through an entire case for hours explaining how he was doing everything in the case. At 7, I was doing this. And so I have a certain familiarity with terminology and the language. And my dad even wrote law books, the highest score ever on the Texas bar exam. So he wasn't just your average lawyer. He actually quit the law at least twice that I know of, maybe 3 times, because he was so disgusted with the good old boy and corruption of the legal system. But that's how he made a living. And so he went back to it. He wouldn't be in a firm anymore, as a partner even, but he practiced law until he finally retired. I used him as an advisor when I began the book Covenants of the Gods, and not really as an advisor, but to kind of read over and tell me, is this true? Is this accurate? Because a lot of the things that you read in the book Covenants of the Gods are going to be iconoclastic, and so I wanted some other opinion, same way with a free church report. My father had passed by the time I wrote that book, but I took that to some of the most prominent attorneys in the United States, and at great personal expense had them read it to tell me, is this true, what we're presenting in there? Is this accurate? And they were blown away. They absolutely were blown away. They passed it amongst themselves through a team of attorneys, fortunately not at my expense, but just because of their interest in it. And I could tell you stories about that, but we'll have to save that for some campfire talk. But anyway, in this pamphlet, I asked a couple of questions in my letters to the attorney, to the judge, about this information that was included in this handbook, pamphlet. It's a small little tiny book. And I should have a copy of it somewhere around here, as well as a copy of all the letters. And in the article that we'll present, we'll give you a link to see some of the letters that I wrote, at least. And in those letters, I quote the judge and the court administrator so that you can kind of see the progress. I don't have all the letters included, but enough so that you can see the progress of what I was doing. One of the things you hear occasionally from judges is that they don't want to play word games. I actually heard a judge say that, we don't want word games in my court once. And that's actually kind of funny, because 90% of what you see in a courtroom is word games. It's all word games. It's all show. It's trying to take the mind of the jury to where they want it to go. And they're playing games with the judge even. He doesn't want word games with him because he knows the game. But he doesn't mind word games in his courtroom. He knows that's what the courtroom is all about. That's why it's important to know the meaning of words and all the meanings of words. Because if there are two different kinds of juries, you know, one that has certain powers and one that doesn't have certain powers, when you use the word jury, It's not detailed enough. It's not descriptive enough. Because one jury has a tremendous amount of power, and the other one really has no power whatsoever. It supposedly has the power to decide fact, but I can show you many cases where the judge, because he has the right to decide law, overrules the jury. He just overrules them. They decide one way, he says, no, we're going to throw the jury's conviction out or acquittal out, and we're going to put another result in. That actually happens. But anyway, I can give you hundreds of quotes about jury nullification. We could just go through them. We could fill up a couple hours going through all the quotes from the Supreme Court, from other courts, from writings of lawyers and historians about jury nullification being a right, not a privilege or merely a power, but an actual right and even a duty. In the first letter, I quote only a few of these places where you can get information like that. Chief Justice John Jay, who in 1794, in George versus Brailsford, in reference to the power of the jury to decide fact and law, he said, "You have the right to take it upon yourself to judge of both." In other words, power, judge of both fact and law. And he goes on to say, to determine the law as well as the facts in controversy. So he's saying, this is John Jay, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, is saying that a jury has that right. Others also called this power a right, including the second president of the United States, John Adams. He not only said that the juror's right, but his duty to find a verdict according to his own best understanding, judgment, conscience, though in direct opposition to the direction of the court. So he's saying it's your duty. But a lot of Americans are not attending to their duty. As a matter of fact, they give up their right to their duty. Now, in the first letter, I was simply asking a question, and the answer was right in my letter, as well as in the original handbook. The answer was already there, but not directly, you know, question, answer. But it's in the context if you know how to read these documents. And everybody thinks, well, I read it. But you don't necessarily understand, because you need a certain amount of information when you're reading things in order to hang what you are reading upon. And a lot of people are completely unaware of the history surrounding juries and jury nullification. So therefore, they don't really understand what they're saying in there. And again, this goes back to those word games, because they have a way of wording it where you actually think they're saying this, and they're really not. They're saying something else. And we'll show you. I'll give you a quote right out of the jury handbook. It says, quote, although some people may claim that a jury can nullify, and he has that in quotes, the law, this view is legally incorrect and severely prejudices the administration of justice, period. Then he says, jurors who disregard the trial judge's instructions have violated their oath. Now, they're not saying you don't have a right to decide fact and law. He's saying that you're violating your oath. And that's very important to understand, that he's not saying, they're not saying you don't have the right to decide fact and law, and there's a reason why they're not saying that. And that is not the intention there. They're just saying that it's legally incorrect to say that they have the right. They don't even say that. Claim the power to nullify the law is legally incorrect because you'd be violating your oath. And there's two things. And you would be severely prejudiced is your ability or the court's ability to administrate justice. And those are huge things. And the article goes into it in a little bit more detail, but I'm going to go around and mention a lot of things that the article doesn't say so that you have something to hang all this on. The bar is not saying you do not have that right. That's basic, to decide fact and law. But they are saying that you would be in violation of your oath if you disregarded the trial judge's instructions. The first question that you might want to ask is, if I did not take the oath, do I still have the right to decide fact and law? Well, of course. You wouldn't be in violation of the oath if you didn't take the oath. So then another question could arise, do you even have to take the oath to be on the jury? And then what oath do you take? What is the oath that you take? And of course, we'll explore all this, and we're kind of getting ahead of ourselves. So we'll go back and take a look at a little bit more, set the scene, so to speak. I pointed out to the judge and to the court administrator in subsequent letters that John Adams and the Chief Justice Jay are not just some people, which you see mentioned, although some people may claim. These guys are claiming that you have the right to decide fact and law. And John Jay and Holmes and all these other people, Chief Justice Stone, Justice Gray, Justice Holmes, all believe that you had this right to decide fact and law. And it was even a duty. And they stated it in court cases. I didn't even bring up Article 1, Section 16 of the Oregon Constitution, which states, quote, "The jury shall have the right to determine the law and the facts." I didn't mention that. And the reason why, I wanted to give the judge a chance to simply answer the question. And the question was, is it the nature of the oath or the nature of the court or a combination of both that allows for this change from jury nullification being a right to something that you cannot do? And of course, the answer is it's both. The oath and the nature of the courts have both changed. The nature of the oath and the nature of the courts have both changed. When I asked him this question, he did not answer it. He was a very friendly letter, but he didn't say he didn't know the answer. He said he cannot tell me the answer. Now, why he can't tell me, he didn't tell me that either. But he said he cannot tell me the answer. But in this very friendly letter that he wrote back to me, he said that it'd be good if I contacted the court administrator. So evidently he believed that the court administrator could tell me what he could not tell me, but he couldn't tell me. And actually that tells us something right there, that the court administrator has more power or knowledge. Court administrator isn't even a judge. It's an administrator. It's a special counsel, it may be a lawyer, it's actually a woman by the name of Cross, and so I wrote them. Anyway, we'll get into how the courts have changed when we return to Keys to the Kingdom after a brief break.
My name is Mark and I'm from Melbourne in Australia, and I'm a minister in the church established by Jesus Christ more than 2,000 years ago. After reading the books published at hisholychurch.org, I realised that mainstream Christianity had taken a wrong turn by forgetting what Jesus said to do, to practice pure religion while remaining unspotted from the world. What does this mean and how is this done exactly? You'll find out when you go to hisholychurch.org and discover what it truly means to love God and your neighbour as much as yourself. Join the Living Network at hisholychurch.org.
I'm Brother Justice, and I'm a minister of His Holy Church of Sacramento, California. His Holy Church is a powerful weapon in the hands of God. The books, The Covenants of the Gods, and Thy Kingdom Come has changed the course of my life forever. For those of you who are truly looking for the way, I encourage you to look to His Holy Church at www.hisholychurch.org. May the good Lord bless you and keep you.
Hi, I'm Brent. I'm a contact minister for the Living Network in Northeast Missouri. You're not the only one out there with the desire to learn the truth. There are people all over the world coming together in faith, hope, and charity. Join us at one of the upcoming gatherings to meet new people, fellowship, work, and play. Whether it's the Fall Burning Bush Festival in Oregon or the Spring Gathering in Northeast Missouri, you'll get all the details when you join the Living Network. Go to hisholychurch.org and click on the network link. Find out what you've been missing. You'll be glad you did.
Welcome back to Keys of the Kingdom. We're talking about jury, and we're talking about changes in the court and changes in your relationship with the court and with government in general, because the courts are government courts. They're not really people's courts. They're government courts. They're created by the government. They're actually legislative courts. But how did that relationship change? Well, of course, the oath will change it. Any kind of oath, any kind of declaration under penalty of perjury will change your relationship with somebody else. But also through acts or lack of acts, sloth and covetousness, and of course taking these oaths, all contribute to a reconstruction, both of local courts since about the 1900s at least, along with a continued reform of the federal judiciary in 1937, which at least one individual refers to as an attempt to make democracy king in America. And you can find that in Documents of American History by Henry Steele Commager. These changes in the nature of the courts and our relationship with the courts and our relationship with government in general have brought about a different system of law. It's changed that system. Go back to that analogy with cancers. Certain elements of society are the responsibility of the people. If the people do not exercise their responsibility, like white blood cells in the body, as a part of the immune system to tyranny in society, then tyranny may grow, actually flourish in society, which will eventually lead to the destruction of society. So with that in mind, we will give you an opportunity to understand this more, but here from this handbook alone, we should see clearly that you waive a right by taking an oath. On page 2 of the letter that I wrote, I point out that the Oregon Bar is telling us in their handbook this view that the jury has a right to decide fact and law, quote, is legally incorrect because, quote, jurors who disregard the trial judge instructions have violated their oath, not because they did not once have that right. So they're telling you that right there, because they violated their oath. Well, you just automatically assume that you have to take this oath, or you assume that the oath binds you in some way, that now to exercise what used to be a right is a violation of the oath. And because you took that oath before the judge can now punish you for violating your oath and exercising your right. And you think, well, these are inalienable rights. They can't do that. Well, yes, they can. You can lose access to your inalienable rights. They still exist. You just can't reach them. They're out of your reach because you have contracted with somebody and saying, you know, I mean, you have a right to do a lot of things. But if you sign a contract where you say, I'm not going to do that, and if I do that, you can punish me and penalize me, then you can't exercise that right anymore. You have to fulfill the obligation of the contract. Contract makes the law. And that, of course, is why we're told to avoid such contracts. But anyway, again, we're getting ahead of ourselves. But what is the nature of the courts? How do we know they have changed? Simply by reading the Oregon Bar, what the Oregon Bar stated. And they told you, because the oath has been entered into this. Also, there's a key word here, the administration. These are administrative courts, not common law courts. I escalated my responses to the point where the special counsel at the Office of State Court Administrator was backed into kind of a corner and finally advised me to consult the internet if I wanted an answer to the questions I was asking that they wouldn't provide. They had actually taken me off on a tangent where they were mentioning a case saying, trying to infer that Oregon courts didn't have the right to jury nullification. And they gave a particular case, and I was familiar with that case. I actually knew the people involved in that case, and it really had nothing to do with that. And I sent her back an explanation, and that really kind of backed her into a corner. And then I added with that several more of these quotes, including, I think, eventually the Article 1 section that says the jury has the right to decide fact and law. And she really had no place to go. It was a series of letters back and forth, and I would feign a little bit of ignorance in order to allow them to make certain statements and then back them into corners so that they couldn't go down those escape routes. See, normally these people are in the business of, you know, somebody ask them a question and then they poo-poo it, or they throw out something that you're unfamiliar with, and you think they've given you a reason, and they haven't. You know, it's just like the handbook to begin with, saying that it's legally incorrect to think that you have the right to nullify the law. Again, they didn't say the right to nullify the law. They say it's legally incorrect, this idea, this view. And then they bring in an additional element, this oath. Well, if you don't take the oath, you still have the right. So why do you have to take the oath? And what oath do you have to take? When they ask you to raise the right hand, I assume, you would assume, right, that they're going to read you off an oath that's in the statute that you have to take. And everybody just raises their right hand and they take that oath. Actually, when I was called for jury duty, I didn't raise my right hand, and they said fine. Everybody else raised their right hand and they took the oath. I sat down and nobody said you have to leave. I was still there. Just most astounding. And actually what I found most interesting is none of the other jurors asked me why you didn't have to take the oath. And the truth is, nobody had to take the oath. but nobody asked me that, so I couldn't get into that conversation. So anyway, she eventually said, consult the internet, because she wasn't going to tell me either. So, which I thought was, that's it? You ask them a question and they tell you to go consult the internet? Go look in a haystack for your needle? I already knew the answer, which is why I'd orchestrated this conversation back and forth, and she realized that she wasn't going to get away with what she normally gets away with other people, which almost probably never happens because nobody probably even asked them the question. The judge gave me the impression that he was actually delighted that somebody actually showed some interest, you know. He's probably a very intelligent guy, actually. I know him, met his wife, and he was willing to engage to some degree, just wouldn't tell me the answer because it's kind of a secret. Nobody wants you to know what's really going on, but we're telling you, and that's why we published this article. But the question I asked her, which really finally bore some fruit from my conversations with her, is one of the oaths asked of the jury evidence of an agreement to waive the right of the jury to determine the law? And then I went on to say, what are the oaths that jurors are asked to take? Can you send me a copy of them? And her response was, there is no oath designated by statute, by any rule, written down, that all courts must use to swear in a jury. They're just making it up as they go along. They're just making up an oath. Now, I don't believe that they are just making up that oath. I believe that there's a memo somewhere saying what they have to do. Judges go and get instructions from who? From the Supreme Court? No, from the court administrator. The court administrator is telling the judges what to do because these are legislative courts. And so before they have voir dire, because I wrote the trial court administrator, I says, from what I understand, an oath is called for before voir dire of a jury selection process, and also another oath is called for before a juror is seated and the trial begins. Will you please send me a copy of these oaths? I have never received a copy from them since then. They don't send it. They don't want you to know what it is, so I guess you have to go in there and take shorthand down when they ask the oath, because you're not going to get a copy otherwise. Although somebody might get it, because, you know, bureaucracy's a wonderful thing, bureaucracies, because everybody, you know, they're so used to doing what they're told. I think if you could probably walk in there and say, can I get a copy of the oath that I'm going to take here on jury duty? Oh, yeah, sure. You know, some guy will just print it up for you. Because there really isn't any law against you seeing it. But there's kind of a secret policy, a conspiracy of something or other to keep you from knowing. It's all conspiracies, you know, all history is conspiracies. But all conspiracies are not, you know, devious backroom conspiracies. It's just kind of a conspiracy of attitude, you know. They just, well, we just don't do that. I won't get into it, but we actually, just in general terms, we were confronting somebody in a government office and asking them, you know, politely, if we could do a certain thing that federal statute said we couldn't do. And they said we could do it. And we said, but the federal statute said we can't do it. And they said, well, yeah, but we do it anyway. But we asked them, can you give us that in writing? No, we won't give that in writing. In another case where they said we couldn't do something and they wouldn't let us do it. And I says, well, can you give us that in writing? And they won't give it to you in writing. That's their policy. I mean, you can call it a conspiracy of cowardness or whatever. They're just told, don't ever give anything in writing or something. Anyway, it becomes a taboo. And so anyway, so I ask in the article, so what is going on? Dare we mention the word conspiracy, you know, the C word? Or is this the natural course of events amongst people who fail to learn from history or about the nature of their duty to God and their fellow man? And of course, now the reason I worded that and I put it in italics, their duty to God and their fellow man, is that's the definition of religion. Is your duty, the performance of your duty to God and your fellow man, is the definition of religion at the time of the writing of the Constitution. Now, even if you take the word oath, by its nature, it has been considered a religious act and is defined as a sacred or solemn voluntary promise, usually involving the penalty of divine retribution for intentional falsity and often used in legal procedures. So the taking of an oath is categorized and has been for 100 years as a religious act. Its origin is a religious custom. Now, that's right out of Encyclopedia Britannica. I'm not making this stuff up. Even John Bouvier's Law Dictionary, adapted to the Constitution, written, you know, a couple hundred years ago, and the laws of the United States, defines an oath as a religious act by which the party invokes God. Now, if you are familiar at all with the Bible, a question may now arise in your own minds on the examination of an oath. Which God are we invoking? And I make small g there, because according to the Bible, there are gods many. According to Jesus Christ, ye also are gods. It is written, is it not written, that ye also are gods? There are gods that we are not to make covenants with. Of the inhabitants, where we go, we are not to bow down or serve them. So who are these gods? Well, again, I get ahead of myself. You really need to have a foundation, because when you're going to be an iconoclast, you have to sometimes really wind up with a big swing, because some of these icons are hard to break. So we need to have this groundwork of understanding before we jump off with smacking the idols which have been constructed in our minds. But before we answer any of these questions as to what gods are we invoking, we're going to take a look a little bit more history. And we're not going to get it all through it in this program, so we'll move over to the next, and we'll do a little review next time so that you get kind of caught up. But in America, in its beginnings, men struggled to establish that, quote, the jury has the right to judge both the law and the facts. And who am I quoting there? I mean, I make these quotes. Well, that's 1804, Samuel Chase, Supreme Court Justice and signer of the Declaration of Independence. So he should know. It says, but modern Americans do not cherish the inalienable gift of God and no longer tend to the weightier matters of law, judgment, mercy, and faith. But they quickly waive their right to decide the law by swearing an oath just simply because somebody walks in and says, raise your right hand. They are ignorant of, you know, what oath are we asked to take here? what are the ramifications of this oath? You went to public school, they rang a bell, you went here, you rang a bell, they went here, they said sit down, you sat down, they say stand up, you stand up, and you just do that. You without thinking, without examination, without thought. You are drunken white blood cells. You know, I've seen a video, and we're straying a little bit here, but we're going to make a little analogy. Somebody ate some sugary, I don't know if it was pop or whatever, but they ate some sugar. And immediately the white blood cells begin to become disoriented and sluggish. Sugar makes white blood cells drunk. Too much sugar makes white blood cells act as if they're drunk. And a white blood cell, if it's alert and well, is part of your immune system, moving amongst, it's way bigger than red blood cells, but it's very amoebic looking. It's not as well singularly formed as red blood cells. It moves about more, and it actually, in a video, I've seen it chasing a microorganism that is fleeing ahead of it. And the white blood cell is moving around trying to catch this microorganism. And it eventually does catch it and circles around it and, like the blob, kind of absorbs it and kills it. And that's very important to your immune system. But if you eat sugar, you know, many different kinds of sugar, but if you eat sugar, white blood cells become like drunk, and they don't move as fast, and they don't function as well, and sometimes they just float there. And that's kind of what's happened to the American people. They're not thinking, they're not pursuing liberty. They have become slothful and avarice. And the slothful should be under tribute. They should be in bondage, and they are in bondage, and they should be. And that's because we have changed the nature of society and our relationship to it and become drunk on the benefits of society, on the rhetoric, and on the pride of society. And that's a huge mistake. So I say in the article, but modern Americans do not cherish this inalienable gift of God and no longer tend to the weightier matters that Jesus lists off, which is law, judgment, mercy, and faith, but waive their rights to decide the law by swearing oaths in opposition to the words of Christ and the apostles and the early church. Now, what am I talking about here? How did they, early church and Jesus Christ and people like James, deal with things like oaths? What were they doing? What were Christians ready to take oaths at the drop of a hat? No, they wouldn't. Jesus said, swear not. James said, above all else, stop the taking of oaths. These are important things to understand, to comprehend. And most people do not understand or comprehend them. They very much do what they're told when they get into a place like a court setting, and they say, raise your right hand, and they immediately raise their right hand and take an oath. In Matthew 15:18, it says, but those things which proceed out of the mouth come forth from the heart, and they defile the man. So your willingness to bind your conscience to others can defile you. And I wrote a book, Contracts, Covenants, and Constitutions. And in chapter 6 of that book, we deal with this idea of Christian oaths. And, of course, the real destroyers of liberty of the people is he who spreads amongst them bounties and donations and benefits, gifts, gratuities, and benefits amongst you. And we see in Psalm 69:22, let their table become a snare before them, and that which should have been for their welfare, let it become a trap. And other places we see Paul talking about David. His quote back there in Psalm 69:22, and he says, let their table be made a snare, and a trap and a stumbling block and a recompense unto them. And what he's talking about is this desire for benefits, where you pray to men, apply to men, who call themselves benefactors but provide no benefit except through exercising authority one over the other. And if you read about the early Christian church, it was actually referred to as a viable republic in the heart of the Roman Empire, an ever-increasing state. That's a huge concept. It says the union and discipline of the Christian republic, which gradually formed an independent and increasing state in the heart of the Roman Empire. This was actually even before Constantine that this was going on. This is why Christians were feared by men like Marcus Aurelius, is because of the fact that they were well united, their union and discipline. And why? Because they were the entire social welfare of their system. But when they were dragged into court, they were dragged into court because they were considered to be in contempt of court and obstinate. And we'll write some about that as well. But everybody thinks, well, God loves me, Christ loves me, Jesus loves me. But the reality is they tell you in the Bible three different kinds of people that are actually all the same kind of people that God hates. And that's the Nicolaitans, those who commit the error of Balaam, the Balaamites, and Esau. And what did they all have in common? They sold their rights in exchange for benefits. But selling your rights for benefit is not the only way you lose your rights. Taking oaths, which is making a contract, covenant, or constitution with others. You lose rights, access to rights, when you take these oaths. And you need to be aware of that. That's why Jesus said, swear not, not at all. And why James said, above all else, stop the taking of oaths. And the early church did. They wouldn't take oaths. And we go through in that chapter 6, we just go through one situation after another about this taking oaths and swearing allegiance and all this stuff. And we show you examples in history. If we just tell you that's not enough, we actually have to show you examples and other historical documents to help develop that swing as an iconoclast to really break down these walls of unbelief. Now, what you're going to actually end up believing, that will be up to you. That will depend on your faith and your heart. But what are we really pointing to? Is the oath the bad thing? Is being on jury duty the bad thing? What is the bad thing? What? We're talking about the natural state of men. The way they ought to be, the healthy way, the whole way that Christ wants you to be. And if you stray from that, you will not be healthy as a society, as even as an individual. It will lead to destruction. It will lead to a cancerous society that will debilitate you as an individual. And Christ wants you to be whole. He wants you to be healthy. And so he gave us certain guidelines. Do this, do that. Even your food laws in the old Mosaic times, it was really all about health of society and what could make society sick. And so anyway, we'll have to talk about this next time on Keys of the Kingdom when we continue this journey into understanding the weightier matters of law, judgment, mercy, and faith. Till then, may peace be upon your house and may God be with you.
You have been listening to The Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church. For more information on the educational ministry provided by His Holy Church and Brother Gregory, including services, counseling, lectures, books, and other audio materials, please write to His Church at Summer Lake, Box 10, Summer Lake, Oregon, 97640. You can also find us on the web at www.hisholychurch.net.